Welcome to the Victory Podcast.
Hey, Victors, welcome to this episode of the Victory Show. If this is your first time joining us, I'm Travis Cody, best-selling author of 16 books, and I've had the privilege of helping hundreds of business consultants, founders, entrepreneurs write and publish their own books as well. And during that journey, I've discovered a really fascinating pattern. Most businesses hit a revenue plateau, usually around $1 million a year, and they struggle to break through it. So on this show, I sit down with some of the world's most successful CEOs, leaders, and business owners to uncover the strategies they use to overcome those plateaus and scale their businesses to new heights so that you can model them and do the same. So get ready for some deep insights and actionable takeaways that you can implement in your life and business starting today. My guest today is a powerhouse in entrepreneurship and venture capital, bringing a wealth of experience across industries. Ebetuel Beto Pillares has done it all: management consultant, telecom executive, startup founder, restaurateur, professor, and investor. His expertise lies in seed and early stage venture capital and investments, where he helps founders and fund managers navigate the complexities of scaling and fundraising, which is perfect because that's what we're talking about today. As a Kauffman Fellow and Presidio Fellow, Beto has served on the boards of over 24 companies, including the publicly traded Exogen Inc. He's passionate about entrepreneurial transformation, particularly in the Borderplex region, where he provides top-tier mentorship, tech tools, and sources to fuel innovation. He's also a former professor of entrepreneurship and strategic management, holding the prestigious Bill and Sharon Sheriff Endowed Chair at New Mexico State University. With a PhD in international business strategy, an MBA, and a deep commitment to fostering the next generation of entrepreneurs, Beto is a strategist, mentor, and creative at heart. And when he's not shaping the future of venture capital, he secretly dreams of playing percussion in a salsa band and writing poetry in a dimly lit tavern. So Beto, thank you so much for being here today. I'm excited for our conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Travis, and looking forward to sharing some insights. And hopefully this helps some other folks gear up in their next move in their business and life.
So I know this is going to be off topic, but I got to ask, when did the poetry writing start?
It's childhood. It starts with journaling. It starts with, the seven major themes that anyone dabbles with: death, love, loss, nature, those kinds of things. And you put pen to paper, and it's brash, and then you rewrite and take a few English classes, and it becomes a lifelong passion.
I love it. So you have a fantastic story, because you really are, what we in America would consider sort of the quintessential American dream, right? Coming from grassroots and rising to some pretty spectacular adventures in your life. So let's start. Where were you born?
I was born in Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua, Mexico, which is right across the border from El Paso, Texas, where I now reside.
And how old were you when you finally emigrated into El Paso?
I was 4 years old.
So was that your dad coming over for work, or just packed up the whole family and said, let's go? Or what took the family from Juarez over to El Paso?
It was a pack up the whole family. Back then, you had to essentially get sponsorship and be able to be self-sustaining when you moved across the border. So we were able to do that as a family.
Wow. So where does the entrepreneurship come in for you? Like, how do you go from starting and coming over with the family and to a new country? It's a stone's throw across the Rio Grande Canal, as I like to call it. But at what was this something that found you at a young age? Were you always always savvy to business, or did it kind of find you as you went along?
Well, that's an interesting question, because everyone tussles with two things about entrepreneurship. Are you born with it, or do you learn it? And I always thought you have to be born with it. But the reality is that it's both. And among the traits or similarities across most entrepreneurs is one trait that stands out, and that is that you were exposed to entrepreneurship because your father, mother, uncle, cousin usually was an entrepreneur. So that early exposure means a lot. My father and mother were entrepreneurs, so certainly that exposure helped. And to answer the question, it is both. It's nurture and nature. You can learn behavior. You can learn how to be a good entrepreneur, but you cannot learn the choice you make to take the risk.
Sure.
You can know everything about it and still decide not to engage in it.
Well, I was going to say, some of my friends who are very successful entrepreneurs say that one of the hallmarks of being an entrepreneur is you're a little bit crazy, because for most entrepreneurs, there's a high degree of pain and suffering and rejection along the way. So you have to be crazy to, like, I failed for my 37th time. All right, brush myself up. Let's go again.
To your point, as far as the American dream, that particular statement of let's go again is super important, because this is still the place where those chances can be taken, unlike any other place in the world, where you could still take a risk, potentially fail or potentially succeed and have the chance to repeat it all over again. And that is the American dream.
Yeah. And talk to a friend of mine who's a very successful entrepreneur. And even just taking it a step beyond that is the fact that this is one of the few countries that you can risk everything and lose everything and go completely bankrupt and you'll still get another shot. Right. That he was just talking about how just remarkable that is, whatever that net would be, that you could lose everything. And heaven knows, we've got plenty of billionaires who at one point in time, you know, went into bankruptcy and had nothing, rebuilt a big company. So what was it your parents did that was entrepreneurial?
Well, my father was a restaurateur. He owned a meat market. At one point, he owned a candy store, which he had to close down because when you have 8 kids, there's a lot of in-house demand for candy that is not profitable.
For some reason, inventory counts kept coming up off.
That is correct. You know, he had a number of businesses. You know, he had a humble beginning, very, very basic education. And so the path out of poverty was entrepreneurship. And my mother was certainly helped my father in the businesses, but also started a number of small businesses herself. So that exposure means a lot when you're seeing the struggle, but also you see behind that and you see the meaning and resiliency in seeing that. It doesn't necessarily have to be a very large, scalable business. It needs to be something that provides for and advances the family forward.
I love it. So your parents were doing the hustle culture before that was a thing.
That's correct.
So let's talk a little bit then, like, how did that reflect on you in terms of your education? Like, when you finally got to the point where you were going to college, was entrepreneurship what you chose, or did you start going somewhere else?
Well, really the pivot point was early in my senior year in college. I was a decent student and, I really didn't think about college. And my physics teacher, who literally looked like Albert Einstein, big mustache, the nose, the eyes.
Crazy hair.
He said, what do you want to do? I said, well, I don't know. I think I either want to have a small business or go to the military. And he was of Jewish faith. And he said, you want to go to the School of Jewish Engineering? And I said, Jewish engineering? He says, yeah, business.
He's called it Jewish engineering, huh?
Yes. So he put that tongue in cheek and he said, you want to go to Brandeis University? And I just fell in love with the idea of this school named after the first Supreme Court judge of the United States, started by Eleanor Roosevelt and Albert Einstein back in the late 40s. And I applied. I got into college. I think without that sort of silly exchange with one teacher, it wouldn't have happened. And when I went to college, my heart was drawn towards literature. I thought, I want to do this, but I need to figure out how to make money and make a living. So I studied economics. Even then I was bifurcated between, you know, how do I put, you know, a career in place, but how do I dabble in the things that nurture the soul in some level?
That's so interesting because I'm an author, obviously spent career writing, but when I hit that same point where I had been 2 years in college studying essentially arts and went, okay, but I also, you know, I have this nasty habit of liking 3 meals a day and having a roof over my head. So how am I going to do that? So I ended up going into business management because I figured worst case scenario, that can get me into the door to anywhere. And that was the same way of like, what do I do to support myself that allows me to do it? And, you know, now I'm lucky enough where what I love to do is what supports me. But that was very insightful on your part.
Yeah. If I could, you know, in the 7th grade, and just to share a little bit, you know, growing up being one of 8 kids, you know, I got one new pair of pants a year and a pair of shoes and then any hand-me-downs that didn't fit my older brothers, right?
Yep. Very much similar for me.
Yeah. So in the 7th grade, there was this guy that walked into my public high school or public middle school, and he wore a sharp blue suit, red tie, white shirt, nice watch, nice shoes, great hair. He would come in and talk to all the classes. He was a volunteer, someone who worked in industry. I cannot tell you what he did for a living, what his name was, or where he worked. All I could tell you is that I sat there and would look at this guy and say, what do I have to do to wear a suit like that? And so to me, that was even before my high school experience, a little bit of what pivoted into the idea of something different, as simple as wearing a suit. And really, you know, I tie that back to this idea that all of us aspire only to that which we've been exposed to. If you don't get exposed to something, then you don't know what it is or what's out there.
That's great.
Or you have to get exposed to something to say that is possible and I want to achieve that.
You know, it's interesting because that's so fascinating because I agree wholeheartedly with you. And it reminds me of just the entrepreneurial journey where most entrepreneurs, I know myself included, you know, we go through a number of failures, but each failure exposes you to something else. So then the next thing you do, you have more knowledge and more, and a lot of times for me anyway, my business, two of my biggest failures that I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so embarrassed that that happened. Years down the road, something, an opportunity comes up, is like, oh, if I hadn't had that, I wouldn't have been ready for this. I actually just saw somebody on social the other day. He's a very successful business owner, and he posted something I thought was really insightful, where he said, if you knew you're only 30 failures away from your dream life, how quickly would you work at failing? And I thought that's very insightful for that. So I love the journey. I love what you did. What I really want to focus on now is where you're at now, because it's so insightful for you know, this project that we're working on here, which is one, you're working for family office and investing in early stage startups. And you also have your own fund doing early stage startups. You have most of the people I work with are in the startup phase or just past the startup phase. You're now on the you know, the 30,000 foot view of looking down on what, and so I want to talk about that. So from your perspective as being an investor, you know, what are the things that you look for that make you go, that business is going to be successful, versus what are the things you see that you go, those guys are not going to survive the next 2 years?
Yeah, good question. I'll start by saying, what are the five basic things I look for, broadly writ, when I look at a new investment? And they're not necessarily in order, but they sort of are from this perspective. The number one thing, if you're going to be a leader in an industry, you have to be going after a big market. Hmm. If you're going to be going after, I want to be the best XYZ in this corner of town, that's not big enough for venture capital. Because venture capital is risk, and you gotta swing for the fences. So you got to be going after a big market. To me, I define that as you got to be number one or number two in the entire world in that thing. That's it.
Wow.
Be number 50th. You got to be number one, number two, maybe in some industries, number three.
So does that include though, when like, so if it's a startup, if it's somebody, you know, they're under $500,000 in revenue, but they're going, this is the industry and we're going to be the number one here. You're looking at the guys that have the vision of like, yes, we're just getting started, but we're going to take down those three Goliaths over there.
You have to, you can't, you know, there used to be this tendency of showing business plans. They said, yeah, and by year 10, we're going to be 0.01% of the market. Who cares? You know, hey, we're going to be 10% of the market. Okay, that's interesting, because there's a long tail of those that have that 0.01, right? But 10% is significant. So, you know, that's number one. Number two is the team. And it's team, not just individual, because companies don't get built by individuals. Yes, you have leaders and whatnot, but a good entrepreneur has another trait that's super important. And that is, they're able to be persuasive in a way that they persuade people to join their team. They persuade customers, investors, partners. So that ability to persuade is super important. If someone is just by themselves and they're pitching me, I'm asking myself, who have you convinced? Who's joined you on this ride, this crazy thing where you could fail, right? So the team is important. Number three is, do you have something that's protectable? Some technology, some patent, something like that. And why is that important? Because not everything's going to be up and to the right. You're going to bounce around a lot, up and down like a graph. And you need to have something that tells you, well, okay, we missed this one, but we still have a moat, or we can make some mistakes within reason, because not all is lost. If it's a binary outcome, then it's probably too risky for me at that juncture. Number four, have you gone from just the idea to some prototype? Have you tested this out somehow, right? Because it shows initiative. And number five, who's willing to pay you for that? Has someone already put some money down or something to that degree, right? So those five things taken together are really important. Now, to say whether someone's going to make it or not, you know, sometimes I don't know what I'm looking for, but sometimes I know what I'm not looking for. So if I get a slide deck that has a slide there that says competition, none, I'm not interested. That means you haven't thought hard enough about what could go wrong and who's actually out to get your lunch, right?
Wait, you mean people come to you and see, but we serve everybody.
That's right. We have no competition. No one else has done this, right? And in this world of fast information, AI, internet, et cetera, a kid in Africa could be working on the same thing as you are with a cost basis to the pennies, who can scale faster than you can. And that's real. So they got to be aware of the industry and the competition. And the other thing is they got to have empathy, because I do not back entrepreneurs for its success at all costs. You know, why? Because life is too short to do that. You know, I want to be able to rest at night and think about the people that I backed, either with my money or someone else's money. They're out doing good in the world. And this is not a Silicon Valley sitcom series where, like, you know, and make the world a better place. This is real. This is, you know, they're working on something that's meaningful to them. They're building wealth and they're doing it ethically. So if I get a whiff that someone is success at all costs without seeing the strewn of bodies that they would have around them, I'm not interested in that. Life is too short and there's way too much innovation happening to just focus on those.
You know, it's there was an article, maybe it was 2 years ago, when it came out in Psychology Today, where they were analyzing, I think it was Fortune 500 C-suite people. And the thing that came out of it was like 80% of the most successful CEOs of these huge companies, if you analyze them from a psych profile, they would be like heavily sociopathic. So they were making the thing of like, and that was because those guys were like, business is all cause of cruel competition. And then they also looked at them like, how many had been divorced, how many had, you know, it was like 90% were like third marriages. So that's an interesting insight that you're like, you gotta be a cool guy.
I had a text sent to me yesterday by one of the entrepreneurs that I funded, and he said, I'm going for a hike with this person who's a billionaire, who's an extremely well-known person. I mentioned the name, everybody will know who this is. I get to go on a hike with this guy. If you could ask this guy one question, what would it be? I said, I got the question for you. Ask him, if you could trade out your biggest accomplishment to make right your biggest failure, what would each be? And then I told him, and I know what his answer is going to be. So he asked this person that, and the response was, I have no regrets. And that is exactly true. I thought he would answer that. Because at some point, you drink your own Kool-Aid, right? Like success at all costs, which success is important. We thrive on that. There's measures of it and whatnot. But the reality is that nothing happens in a vacuum. You know, I had a professor who used to say, everything is a function of everything else, right? Meaning that, you know, There's a butterfly effect on everything, every decision we make. And so I think the really self-aware person thinks with a wider aperture about all those things, but doesn't stay frozen. They make decisions and they involve others and they test things out and they make the best decisions they can with the best information they have available to get going. And so to scale a business from, you know, one level to the next, you have to take in information. If you know what a regression analysis is, it's sort of a stepwise of loading variables to figure out which new variable adds more information. Mm-hmm. At some point, adding a new variable adds a very small amount. That's when you know, okay, I have enough information to make a decision that will have this kind of impact. And I think, you know, people should really think about that as they say, okay, at one point do we pull the trigger? And I think good entrepreneurs, even if they end up failing, are pulling the trigger more often than not, because they're getting better and better and better at testing out the decision-making capabilities.
That's a good point. You know, and I think that's sort of been one of the consequences in the information age for, you know, what we just came out of, because now we're in the AI age. But the information age, I've worked with people where, well, I haven't got started. I don't know enough. I need to learn more. But let's say, why haven't you started your Facebook ad campaign yet? Well, I don't know enough about Facebook ads. Let me study some more. But by the time you've studied, it's already evolved. And it's like, oh, wait, but that's new. Right. So if you just don't jump in and start figuring it out as you go, like you'll never get started.
That is correct.
So you're working with these companies, you're working at the highest level with the, you know, the leadership teams. What is it that makes for a great leader in terms of like, what are the traits of a leader that you can look at going, that guy, I know he's going to be able to scale and handle the scale as they go? Because there are people that they're leaders, they start to scale and then they, you know, sabotage the entire thing and take the company down because they as a leader don't have the skills to deal with the growth.
You know, in my opinion, one very important trait of great leaders is they know how to make decisions, or they make decisions. Nobody wants to follow someone who just sits on their hands and says, well, I don't know what to do. You know, people need leadership, right? So that's one trait. The other trait is great leaders have great mentors. What that means is that, you know, I'm in the business of incentivizing people with risk capital. And I'm here to tell you that capital is a commodity, right? Capital follows, it's like water, it'll follow the path of least resistance. And if I could offer something to all entrepreneurs, it would be find really good mentors, because that makes a huge difference in your life and in your business. How do you find a good mentor? You think about, again, being exposed to something gives you a shot at what you aspire to, right? Find someone you admire. There are traits in that person or in that business that you admire. Say, how can I emulate that? Because that person is going to teach you how hard it was to get to where they're at. There's an old saying that says, good decisions come from experience. Experience comes from bad decisions, right? Some people get stuck on the bad decision point. And so bad decisions with a lot of experience without making good decisions afterwards is useless, right? And so if you are a good entrepreneur and you aspire to get better, you're going to have some level of bad decisions and you're going to accumulate some experience. But you need to move to that area where you're saying, how do I make better decisions so I have a better experience and better outcomes? And you only learn that by tapping into the knowledge of people who have gone through that process to help you avoid things. And to me, what I look for in an entrepreneur is, look, an average entrepreneur can do great things. But a great entrepreneur for me is not necessarily someone who's intellectually firing much higher than someone else. For me, it's someone who can look at information and learn a little faster than the rate of normal experience. If we take the next 50 years to learn how to speak a language, we'll probably learn how to speak it. But there are some people who can probably pick things up a lot quicker, maybe not across every domain of expertise, but in certain ones of them. I want that person. Now, if someone says, I'm really good at coding this, or I'm really good at selling this, that's who you want on your team. You want to enable people to do their best at which they're really, really good at, and then over-deliver on that, right? And you incentivize them. You do that well. So good entrepreneurs persuade people. Good entrepreneurs are well-mentored. Good entrepreneurs will understand what makes people tick so that they can incentivize alignment or align incentives with that person or group of people, right? And good entrepreneurs also are not afraid to say when they're wrong. Hey, I made a mistake here. I have seen a lot of companies fall apart because the good people leave when they say, well, this person, they did this and they just pretended that nothing happened. I just needed an I'm sorry. Or I just needed, it's like, you know what? We'll do better next time. You know, and so those components are important. And by the way, none of that stuff has to do anything with going to business school. It has to do with how do you want to live your life and how do I bring that into the workplace in a way that, you know, resonates with people? Because at the end of the day, all companies, all governments are made up of people, right? These are not autonomous entities that kind of make independent decisions.
Not yet, anyway.
Not yet. There's human factor in it yet still.
So let's talk a little bit about then, like, why do so many businesses get to around $1 million a year and just sort of get stuck there? I guess from a business perspective, one hand, and then also the leadership perspective, what keeps them from going from one to say three or one to five? And more importantly, second part of that is a lot of people think growth at all costs, right? Business at all costs, but there's also sacrifices and challenges that come from going from $1 million to $5 million a year, or $10 million a year company. So what are those challenges that are going to happen that somebody at $1 million may think, oh, when I get to 5 million, it's going to be fantastic, because they don't realize, oh, when you get to 5 million, here's the new level of problems you're going to be facing.
Yeah. You know, first of all, there's always a tension between resource seeking, right? And market seeking, right? So market seeking is, I got to invest to get this market, right? So, okay, now I got this market. Oh, for me to get that next market, I got to beef up my resources so I can address that market. So that tension between one and the other is, you know, there's a finite amount of resources to a company or even to an individual, right? For instance, we all have the same hours in a day. We need X number of hours to sleep, X number of hours for that. And this, okay, when do I go to school? When do I do this? When do I learn a new skill? When do I scale this? It's finite. Same with a business, right? We have this layer of administrative cost. We have this market that we've learned to address. How do we scale to the next level, right? I'll give you an example. In the trucking industry, there's probably lots of single truck, single driver kind of person. And then you have a ton of, say, 5 to 25 truck, transportation operators. But where it gets really interesting is that about 100 trucks or more. That's where it gets interesting, right? Because then you have serious economies of scale, right? But very few companies, first of all, can't go from that one or two trucks to 10, or that 10 to 25. And very, very few go beyond that 25 to, say, 100 or more. And that happens because we have these channels of thought of the costs and the idea behind how we're deploying these resources. And when it all funnels down and we see kind of the balance sheet and, you know, the income statement, there's a certain pressure on them where we can unlock greater assets or greater capital access than what we already have, unless we think outside of the box, like, okay, is there an asset I can acquire? Is there a new management or a new product? Or can I sell a different product to the same customer that doesn't cost me as much, right? The name of the game is, for every dollar I spend, can I get more than a dollar back in revenue, right? Yeah. And so there's a period in time, particularly in venture capital, it's called the J curve, where you're spending, and you're basically in the red. And at some point, it starts to hockey stick up, because for every dollar you're spending now, you're getting a little more money back, right? So that J curve is very scary, particularly in the tech business, because sometimes you don't know where it bottoms out. Well, do I spend more? And will I eventually be able to start getting money back? So I think it's really hard to scale a business in general, right? Because there are mindsets that we're used to, and there's also a certain comfort. I mean, lots of businesses in the US are under 5 employees, maybe making about $1 million. You know, the owner gets paid relatively well. Maybe he employs a family member or two. Maybe I see this a lot, particularly in mom and pop businesses, where, well, you know, maybe we want a new vehicle and we'll use the vehicle somewhat for business and somewhat for personal. And maybe there's a vacation spot we'd like to go and have a family retreat at, but also there's a business meeting there. And so there's all these confluence of personal and business that becomes very comfortable and inhibits the scale of the business, unless you apply some discipline. And that discipline comes by setting goals that stretch you, sort of like working out. You say, hey, if I work out and I do the same routine every day and then my muscles don't grow anymore, but I look like I got a good pump, then I'm happy. But hey, if I really want to scale, maybe I go a little further out on this kind of muscle building activity, and maybe I feel a little discomfort on this one, and maybe I do this part, and maybe, you know, I tone up here and I lean up here. There's a level of discomfort and muscle atrophy that happens, but that breakdown is what causes that growth. And that little bit of pain helps for that next growth period, right? So that same can be used, say, in the business aspect of it. And so a business owner needs to be able to step outside of the business, look at it and say, what do I need to do to apply something new here so they create that growth? And I'm familiar with one program called the Latino Business Action Network. It's a nonprofit that's partnered with Stanford. It's been around for about 10 years or so. And they take Hispanic-owned businesses that are at roughly $1 million in sales or more, and they want to scale them to 100 million.
Wow.
And they go through an 8-week program taught by Stanford professors, and they get a certificate. And you'd be amazed. There's been about 1,000 graduates from this program that have gone through it. They walk out and said, this blew my mind. And guess what? Some of them are not ready to apply those principles. They're like, man, maybe in a year, maybe in two. And some of them, it just hockey sticks. They were at the right inflection point. The hunger was just right. They really struck a chord with the right mentor. They had the confidence they needed to go talk to that new client, things of that nature. The other thing that happens, and why it's hard to scale a business, is that the sources of capital are sort of this elusive wall that says, hey, I want to put money out into the economy through small businesses or others so they can grow. And so this business comes over and says, well, I'm ready. You know, here I'm at. I'm at this stage and I need capital so I can grow. And then you have a banker or a source of capital saying, yeah, but not yet. Maybe I need this piece of information, or let's give it another year, or let's blah, blah, blah. My point to that is that rejection at that level hurts and hinders a lot of entrepreneurs from saying, maybe I'm just meant to be a small business. Maybe I just can't scale. Or you're scared of being told no, and therefore you say, well, maybe this is just the size of business that I'm going to reach. Instead of figuring out, is there another source of capital, or is there something else I can do to scale faster? So those are some thoughts of why businesses hit that wall and can't quite scale.
So let's talk a little bit about the venture capital space then. What are the challenges that you as a fund manager and you know, working with family offices for the entities that are trying to deploy money, what are the challenges that you guys are facing in regards of knowing how to actually do that?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a couple different buckets of capital, if you will. So in the family office setting, that's usually capital that comes from the profits of another traditional business, some main business, and they either invest in venture capital or different kinds of businesses to diversify, to learn and explore, or to get similar or better returns with some level of risk. And then when you have pools of capital, like a venture capital fund, that's third-party capital. That could be endowments, pension funds. It could be high net worth individuals or family offices saying, okay, you're a manager. You know how to look for deals of this kind. We're trusting you to go find those, invest in those, and we get a return, okay? And here's kind of where the return profile has to be, the kinds of things we want to invest. So there's different kinds of capital moving into venture capital. And so venture capital's challenge is to make a number of bets. You know, you have your diligence questionnaire, you have your process, you have your industry of focus, you have your capital allocation. You know, I'm going to do checks of 250 or a million. or 10 million into companies of XYZ size or in companies in XYZ industry. So you're essentially creating a portfolio to diversify that risk. And on the back end, over those 10 or 12 years, stock market historically has been, I don't know, somewhere between 12 and 15%, real estate between 10 and 12%. So you're trying to do something better than the alternative, right? And also it's fun. I mean, most of the companies we talk about, right? Apple, Google, and Microsoft, Nvidia, these all got started at some point with private capital, venture capital, and things of that nature, right? So those are the sexy ones, right? We know of them because they succeeded, but so many of them did not.
Well, it was Amazon's business model, right? It was the first 12 years or 15 years they were running red. So I remember when I did my business degree, we were actually looking at Amazon as like the business model not to do. Because back then, this was the early 2000s, they were like, Jeff Bezos is being irresponsible with investor money. But later, when they interviewed Jeff Bezos, they're like, why did you do that? And he said, all the people that were poo-pooing on our idea, he's like, they didn't realize that my long-term vision was the anything store. And he's like, I started with books, but knew we could be more. And the phrase he brought up was like, I knew eventually we would reach an economies of scale that no one could compete. It just took a long time. And then, you know, once he did, it was like, it wasn't J curve, it was like, you know, L curve.
Absolutely. But part of that goes to this idea, you know, going back to my initial comment of resource seeking or market seeking, right? So Jeff Bezos said, I'm taking everything and putting it in market seeking. I'm doubling down and I'm going to get little or no growth in terms of margin or profitability because I'm just amassing as much sand as I can, right? And then at some point, I'm going to own the island. And once I own that island, I will own the next island and the next one and the next one. And there's from business school, there's a graph where you say, here's how Amazon started selling books. But then they started publishing books. And then they started just e-publishing books. And then they started transporting their own stuff and warehousing and so on, right? So it became the end all for be all, right? And that takes a very long-term orientation. When I got started with the family office, the patriarch told me, what do you want to do? I said, I want to start the first venture fund in El Paso. Cool. Go write the business plan. It's very exciting to sit with a billionaire every week for a couple of hours and share with him my ideas and stuff and learn and go back over a few months. And then at the end to present my plan and say, here it is. I want to do a $10 million fund. Here's how we're going to invest, blah, blah, blah. And he said, you're thinking too small. And I had these chunks of performance and things broken out in 2-year increments because heretofore, my life always kind of took a pivot every 2 years. He said, you need to think in spans of 20 to 50 years or more. And that blew my mind because I had never thought about thinking in long-term horizons. So to Jeff Bezos' credit, he, from the very beginning, thought in very long-term horizons. And if you have a true north of something you want to achieve, and you think you're on the right path, and you say, okay, these are the mile markers that I need to meet. These are the people that help me get there. These are the inflection points that tell me that I'm, you know, doing well, right? And, you know, again, to his point of being capital efficient over time, you know, there's a storied idea in a very famous picture where he's, you know, in his first headquarters and there's a door as his desk. There's a lot of Amazon lore that goes around that at some point, every executive had to pick a door, right? And use it as a desk for some period of time as an homage to not, you know, to my point of, doesn't matter what you achieve, don't forget where you come from, right? Those roots are super important. Most companies in their headquarters, you walk in, you're going to see the mission, vision, and values of a company. Why is that? It's not just because you want to say, hey, this is what we stand for, because you want everybody who walks in there to drink the Kool-Aid, the employees, the vendors, the customers, to every day be reminded of that. And that's super important. And so, you know, there's a lot of entrepreneurship that happens by accident or by necessity. Very little entrepreneurship happens because of strategic planning. Okay. So there's data out there that shows that entrepreneurship right now is there's a lot of people in their 50s going off to start businesses. Is it because in your 50s you have this brilliant idea and you say, now's the time to do it? Well, there's some truth to that because maybe your kids are older, maybe your house is paid off, maybe you can take a different risk. But a lot of times it's because you got downsized. And so what's your option? I got to go start a business because I'm competing. My resume is competing with a bunch of 20-some-year-olds who are willing to get paid half as much and are willing to work twice as many hours, right? So my alternative is to go start a business. And I'm starting out of necessity, not because I have a long-term vision of how to grow this business. So going back to the point of why are some businesses at like $1 million? Well, that 55-year-old guy went and started a business. He's now making $1 million in that business, paying himself to 50. Maybe he was making 300 in his business. I mean, in his job before with nice benefits. But you know what? $1 million business doesn't feel so bad because at least I have the certainty that it's up to me, right? So there's this need to motivate people to do more, not for the sake of doing more, but because the capacity inside of each individual exists and it needs to be unlocked.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things there. One, what a remarkable experience to be sit with a billionaire and have him go, you're not thinking big enough. You know, I shared before the call, like I have a client that he took his company from 6 employees to 187 in, I want to say 3 years or 4 years, you know, 2 million a year in revenue to last year, I think they did 120 million. And he shared with me, he had the opportunity to, when he was in Austin, he got a tour of the Tesla factory from Elon Musk. He made the arrangements and they were like, you got 20 minutes with Elon. He's going to walk you from one end of the factory to the end of the factory. And I said, what was the big insight that you got from that trip? And he just looked at me and he said, I spent 20 minutes with Elon Musk and I walked away from that realizing I am not thinking big enough. And this is a guy running $100 million a year company. The 20 minutes with Elon, he's like, that's not enough. And so I think, so what is it then? What is your, like when you're working with leaders, how do you, knowing that this is sort of a cultural thing of, oh, $1 million is enough and don't be greedy and don't be that and, you know, just be comfortable with what you have. How do you work with leaders to help them? Are there steps that you take them through to help them begin to have a 10-year, 15-year, 20-year vision?
Yeah. So, you know, I have a question that I ask every entrepreneur, typically before funding. And I ask them, do you want to be rich or do you want to be king? And by and large, I'd say 50% have a quick response to that. And then the other 50% kind of take a long time because they're trying to figure out, what does this person want to hear from me? Right? They haven't thought about that before. Maybe they have, but they don't want to answer. And truthfully, there's no right or wrong answer. You can be king or you can be rich in terms of a desire. But the reason I ask that question is because I'm trying to get at, if I give you risk capital, which is very expensive, do you care about making money? Because the only way I make my money back and then some is if you make money. Because I don't care if you want to be king. You can be king of your small company and have no outside ownership and everything is yours. But that's not important to me. That could be great for a small business. But I want you to be big because I want an outsized return for my money. So that's the first question I ask. You want to be rich or you want to be king? Again, no right or wrong answer. But if you want to be king, chances are you shouldn't take outside capital, okay? Because you're not ready for that. So let's say you want to be rich. Okay, great. What does that look like? This work backwards. Is it a public company? Is it acquired for XYZ? You know, is it merged with this kind of company? What does that look like? You know? What does the exit look like? And by the way, most businesses in the US do not plan on exits. There's a lot of businesses where the founder passes away and the family doesn't know what to do with the business. It happens a lot. It happens a lot in the Southwest. Okay?
Especially when you have a really successful business and suddenly they're like, oh no, what do we do with this?
Yeah. And so, you know, the smart entrepreneur starts to think about succession planning inside or outside the family, right? They start to think about, okay, new products, diversification, you know, ways to really enhance the business productivity. What does the exit look like? So I want entrepreneurs to think about that. So a slide in the deck that I get better have something about, I thought about the exit. Maybe I haven't thought about it a lot, but I think this is what's possible.
Yeah, that seems to me to be a uniquely American thing where entrepreneurs don't think about the exit.
That's correct. That's correct.
You know, I've worked with some phenomenally successful online marketers and they've built kind of a personality business. And, you know, from the outside, you look at it like, oh my gosh, this guy's making $8 million a year. And then I've gone in and worked behind the scenes and I go, this guy is trapped. He can never sell his business because his business is him.
That is
and
correct.
I was like, that's actually what led to me creating the brand that I did, because I was building a Travis Cody business and I went, wait, I can't sell that if I ever want to leave.
You know what you have? You have a job, not a business.
Yeah.
Because you're tied to that, right? The definition of a business is when you can walk away from it and come back and nothing broke, right? It still runs well, right? So once an entrepreneur says, I want to be rich, right? Not because that's what motivates me solely, but because I know that's a way to create wealth. That's how we're measured in certain areas. Okay, so what does that look like? Okay, it looks like this. Okay, what do you need to build? And what do you need to bulletproof so you can walk away and come back or potentially hand the reins to someone else? Maybe you still own equity in that and you know that equity will be worth something someday, right? So those are the conversation points. And they vary company by company, right? Because some companies have, you know, a very dynamic industry where things move very quickly. And so the name of the game there is how do you scale as fast as possible? Because if you don't, then you stay behind. Others, like let's say biotech or advanced materials, you can move a little slower because those are hard things to do. And when things are hard to do, very few people do them and even less do them well, right? Mm. You can take your time. And if you know you're going up the mountain and you're going to reach it, you're going to reach it before others, then you have the 800-pound gorilla, you're the winner, right? But it's rolling rocks uphill and it's hard. But ultimately, you know, also want those entrepreneurs, because I've had these conversations with entrepreneurs. I had an entrepreneur once who said, I really want to do this. Great. After 6 months, we said we funded him and he was engaged and then he gets married and he had a basic salary. And 6 months into his marriage, he calls me up and says, so my wife wants me to go back to the workforce so I can make three times as much because for me as an entrepreneur making this much doesn't make sense. But I'm very committed to the business. What do you think I should do? It's like, never ask me to help you decide between your marriage startup. No, you know, it's the wrong question, right? You know, and so long story short, he left the company. We plan on succession. The company did fine after that.
So isn't that interesting though, too? Because even that comes down to a lack of long-term thinking.
Absolutely. You know, sometimes we think that it's sort of like, okay, I got selected to run the marathon, or I got the number to run the marathon. You haven't run the race yet. You know, you got the privilege to get in line to run. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs that raise money think that raising the money was a goal. No, it's not. It's just the pressure to actually deliver on having raised money now.
Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. As we wrap things up here, say somebody's listening to this conversation, is a younger entrepreneur just starting their journey. And I say younger, right? It could be the 55-year-old guy that's just starting his own business, but a fresh entrepreneur, let's put it that way. What advice do you have for someone that it's just kind of at the beginning of their entrepreneurial journey?
First advice is on capital. And that is bootstrap as long as you have to. Absolutely. Why? Because you also feel the pain and pressure of what it's like to go through this. Number two is, surround yourself with people who are better than you at different skill sets, because that's the only way you learn. Number three, identify what your zone of genius is. What are you really, really gifted at? And how do you surround yourself with the assets and resources so you can practice that as much as possible? Because the world's a better place if you can do that, because you're giving it your best, and you're enabling others to support and to excel in that area. Number four, don't take yourself too seriously. Yeah, I have a nice business card that says president, founder, CEO, that kind of stuff, but you're always learning. It's a learning process all the way through. Number five, always give back to your community. Mentor, visit schools, participate in things that you're not necessarily getting compensated at. You're going to learn something from that. You're going to find blind spots that maybe you weren't aware of. Those five things or four things are super important. They start to sharpen you as a person and as an entrepreneur, and it has nothing to do with the actual business you're doing.
Love it. Well, the irony isn't lost on me that you're in a business of taking bets, and bet is the first part of your name. Beto, thanks so much for your time today. It's been fascinating.
My pleasure.